If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game. And oh boy, do we have some exciting news for you today. I'm Kevin Day and he is Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. And later we will be joined by the award-winning journalist and writer Michael Calvin about his brilliant new book, Whose Game Is It Anyway? But first, Kieran, we have some news stories and I never thought this would happen. Kieran, anyone playing the Price of Football bingo today is in for a, is in for a potential big win, because our first story, Kieran, is about amortisation at Derby County. Kieran, it's about amortisation at Derby County.
It is perhaps all of my dreams come true in many respects, and nightmares in others, sadly, as far as Derby are concerned. Fans were celebrating on Saturday after the 3-3 draw. And Rotherham conceding a goal in the last couple of minutes, which allowed Derby to escape relegation. And we did speak about the club on Sunday, or in terms of Monday's show. And I was aware that the EFL had tried to appeal the charges against Derby. Derby successfully defended the charges against them, which arose earlier in respect to, first of all, the sale of Pride Park, and that one's been put to bed. Mm-hmm. But amortisation, I don't want to bore people too much about it. It's about, you know, how do we deal with transfer costs when a player joins? And 99% of clubs do it one way, where let's say that you sign a player for £10 million over on a four-year deal. So you say, well, that's £2.5 million a year for each of the 4 years. Four times two and a half gives you £10 million. So that's fine. What Derby do is they effectively say, well, in year one, we'll charge a couple of hundred grand. In year two, we'll charge a couple of hundred grand. In year three, we'll charge a couple of hundred grand. And then in year four, final year of the contract, we'll put through a huge amount in terms of the transfer fee. Mm. Now, is that acceptable? Is that not acceptable? I've looked at the small print. The simple answer is it depends. It depends how good your lawyers are, and our silver tongue friends, frankly, will be looking at. They're probably going on a SpaceX with Elon Musk with the fees they'll be reaping from these types of things. So the EFL charged. The EFL appealed. Looking at the documents that have gone up on the EFL's website, and you've got to applaud them for sticking the documents up. And this ran to tens and tens and tens of pages. The criticism of the EFL's expert witness was perhaps a bit harsh at the initial case. The EFL have made some progress, but do we know what's going to happen next? The simple answer is no, apart from it's going back to another review panel. It did seem to me rather strange that they've just had these charges and they've appealed before a committee, in effect, on which there were lots of lawyers and no accountants. And you know, they're equally dull people. I'm not saying that accountants are exciting. But it did mean that they were sort of trying to come to some form of conclusion without necessarily having a lot of experience in these matters. So that's where we are. The Derby are using as their defence that the auditors approved the new policy. And the trouble is, auditors are there to be independent observers, and that's good. You know, we're in favour of independent observers, but. Yeah, in a classic sort of Caesar's wife situation, it would help if they made a bit of effort to look independent as well. So when you find out that the audit firm involved a few years ago had the naming rights to one of the stands at Pride Park, it doesn't look too clever. And then the audit partner who signed off the accounts, if you go to his profile on the website, he describes himself as a passionate Derby County supporter. It just doesn't look smart, in my view.
And, of course, worryingly, there will be some optimistic Sheffield Wednesday fans out there hoping for a post-dated points deduction, which is probably not going to happen. But to make matters worse for Derby, Kieran, as well, and historical stories come back to bite them on the bum as well.
Yes, this is in respect of the former captain, Richard Keogh. For people not familiar with what happened, and Derby County under when they were Frank Lampard's Derby County, as they were officially known, of course, at the time, they had a bonding night out, which involved a load of the players getting smashed, you know, having a few drinks and having far too many drinks. Richard Keogh, who was the club captain at the time, I think he was 33, perhaps. He got into the back of a car, which was driven by another one of the players. The other player, it looks as if he may have had a few drinks as well. And two players had a race in their cars. One of the cars ended up smashed into a lamppost or a tree. And Richard Keogh got a huge injury on the back of this. It looks as if the players ran away, his colleagues, which doesn't reflect particularly well on them. And then, somewhat strangely, Keogh was charged with gross misconduct by Derby and had his contract cancelled. Initially, they did offer him a contract after the injury because it was going to take a large period of time before he recovered. But they were that the new contract was on substantially less generous terms, which he rejected. So they sacked him for gross misconduct, and he took his case to a tribunal. And he's just been awarded £2.3 million in compensation. So, it doesn't reflect particularly well on the club. You know, for me, well, you know, getting into the back of a car isn't necessarily gross misconduct. The fact that he wasn't driving, well, he can't drive by all accounts. But normally when you get into the back of a car, you assume the person in the front of the car behind the wheel does know what they're doing and has also had a little bit of self-awareness in terms of being able to drive the thing whilst not inebriated. And there's one final thing in respect of Derby, just to get it all out of the way. Our very good friend, Eric Alonso, the guy that claims he's going to buy the club, he pulled up sort of... He put up on social media footage of a absolutely amazing looking apartment with sort of the implication that this is his pad, and people going, "Wow, oh, God, blimey, Eric, you are the man. Yeah, perhaps you are this incredibly wealthy individual that you keep alluding to." And then, you know, fair play to an eagle-eyed fan who said, "Hold on, I've seen that before." And it turns out that it's footage from that somebody else had put up on Instagram of their real apartment in Bel Air, which apparently is worth $42 million. All that we know since then is that Eric Alonso's gone very quiet, and I think he's deleted his Twitter account. So, my view, and this is just an opinion, is that Derby County would be dodging a bullet. Yeah. If he doesn't go ahead with the deal, but maybe proved wrong. He could turn out to be an incredibly philanthropic billionaire, and they're going to win the Champions League in 4 or 5 years' time, as appears to be the voices in his head.
I'd be quite pleased to have a club owner who thought he could get away with putting a picture up of somebody else's house and claiming it was his. I just like the idea that he's sitting at home going, what gave it away? Well, Kim Kardashian in the kitchen gave it away, I think, Eric. after a story that's got Derby and amortisation in it, everything else is a sad anticlimax, I'm afraid, Kieran. unless we've got a story coming up that involves Mike Ashley and Steve Dale mud wrestling in a Moscow nightclub. But what more?
I'd pay for pay per view. I'd get my $14.95 out for that.
Yes, is that a euphemism? No, it's an actual amount of cash. That's all you try. Oh, fair enough. Yes. I wonder why does he call it? It's $14.95. If it's centimetres, I'm not worried. What more, Kieran, do we know about the news we mentioned on Sunday regarding Manchester United's shirt sponsorship deal with tech company TeamViewer and their training kit deal with the Hut Group, which in particular seemed to be in some doubt?
Yes. What's happened in terms of TeamViewer is that a significant element of the Manchester United fan base have started up the hashtag Not A Penny More campaign with a view of trying to say that they love Manchester United, but they don't like the Glazers, the amount of money that the Glazers have taken out the company, the failure to invest in Old Trafford, and there was some footage on Wednesday night put up by a journalist of he's trying to type his copy and there's water dripping through the roof. So you know, there is an ongoing issue with the lack of investment in Old Trafford as a stadium. Those people that have looked at the small print of both Project Big Picture and Super League may have seen that there was a some sort of capital expenditure fund where effectively money would be given to clubs to allow them to invest more in infrastructure and facilities, i.e. you're getting other clubs to pay for your upgrade of your stadium. So whether this is part of the long-term plan of Manchester United, because of course they were involved very, very centrally with both of those projects, were they just trying to delay spending money on the stadium because they were hoping that it was going to come from somebody else? We don't know. But the Not A Penny More campaign is Manchester United fans contacting sponsors and saying, we're not going to engage with your products. And you know, TeamViewer suffered from this in terms of something called Trustpilot. And a friend of mine put up a rather negative review of Manchester of TeamViewer, and he's now been contacted by Trustpilot to say that they will only upload reviews if you can show an invoice that's been received from TeamViewer. So you know, Manchester United fans really got this across quite well. So that was that's their new front of shirt sponsor. And as far as their training kit sponsor, you know, Manchester United are a big enough brand, they're a big enough club to have separate sponsors. This is presently held by the American insurance company AOL. That deal was due to expire on the 30th of June, and something called the Hut Group was going to take over on the 1st of July. And if the stories are correct, this is a £200 million 10-year contract. And the Hut Group have now said, in the light of recent events, we are having second thoughts, which doesn't give Manchester United a lot of time to get a new training gear sponsor. So this could be seen to be a victory for fan power. I think the problem isn't Manchester United. You know, Manchester United as an institution, as a football club, as a brand, are global. You can be impacted by elements within it, and that element is the Glazers. Ed Woodward is going, so he's probably not a positive in terms of Manchester United status, but at least he's fallen on his sword. But the Glazers continue to be closely associated with the club, and the rather staged managed events that we've seen from, I think, Arsenal, Chelsea, Spurs and Manchester United with attempts to try to appease the fans through some form of fan engagement, I don't think is going to win people over unless these things are taken seriously by the clubs as opposed to just trying to fob them off with platitudes and pretend benefits.
Issues that we explore a bit further in our interview with Michael coming up. If the contract has been signed, Kieran, already between Manchester United and Hutt Group, would there not be a penalty for either side pulling out so quickly into the arrangement?
I suspect there is, Kevin. I'm absolutely with you with regards to that. Also, there will be in the agreement some form of good behaviour clause. So we saw this with, if you think about, Tiger Woods and Lance Armstrong, when their activities came more to light, that sponsors were actually able to walk away from the deal. It could be argued, and I'm not a lawyer, and I'm sure there are silver tongue friends who will correct me on this, it could be argued that Manchester United's recent behaviour in terms of setting up or its involvement with the Super League has potentially damaged their good reputation element of the contract. And this, I'm sure this is being pored over by Hutt Group's legal team as we speak to see whether they can get actually a clean break on the deal.
I could hear your brain whirring as you tried to come up with something to describe Lance Armstrong and Tiger Woods' behaviour. So activities was very good. Well done. Well done, Kieran's brain, for coming up with that so quickly. In another exercise in Italian door closing after stable horses bolted, Juventus have been told they face expulsion from Serie A if they remain part even of the proposed Super League.
Yes, the position is it looks as if nine clubs definitely withdraw from Super League, then it implodes and then the contracts are effectively voided. I'm basing this on some of the stories we've read. Juventus are still in it, and Yelly is still saying it's a beautiful creation. And ultimately, it's their choice. There is actually nothing to stop them from setting up Super League with Real Madrid and Barcelona and playing each other as many times as they wish next season. And I'm looking forward to that being whittled down to two teams who'll go and play in the cup final. Now, what's happened is that Gabriel Gravini, who is the chief executive, the chairman of Serie A, he went on to a Naples radio station called Kiss Kiss.
Nice.
Which, so good they named it twice. And he said that ultimately it's Juve's choice if they want to maintain their involvement in Super League, then under, as far as his interpretation of the rules, they would no longer be able to play in Serie A. And would the league survive? Well, it survived when Juventus got demoted for financial misconduct recently. It's a great club. Ultimately that's their choice. There is also talk as to where do UEFA stand if Real, Barcelona and Juve maintain their position in terms of Super League. Does that therefore result in those clubs effectively saying, well, we don't want to play in UEFA's Champions League next season? So there's a lot of gumboat diplomacy taking place. There does appear to be a lot of resentment from these three clubs towards new money. But Real Madrid, who are claiming to be the victims in all of this, and they're trying out to save football. Real Madrid have won the European Cup, the Champions League, 13 times. The two clubs with new money who are going to contest it, Chelsea and Manchester City, have won it one time between them. So I don't think Real are quite the victims that they like to portray themselves as. And also sort of lurking in the background of this is the belief of Perez at Real Madrid that if the English clubs who have withdrawn from Super League go through formally with their withdrawal process, then an awful lot of fines are going to have to be paid by those clubs, and therefore that will have to be paid as compensation to, who's it going to be? Oh, well, Real Madrid, yeah. Barcelona and Juventus. So, yeah, it's very tawdry. The ownership models of Real and Barcelona, which some people do champion in the sense that it is a presidential model, does have some merit. But then, you know, if you take a look at the American presidential approach, it does get embroiled in brouhaha. If I was standing as the potential president of Real Madrid and said, well, my intention is to ensure that we've got sustainability in terms of the club, to balance its budget, to make sure that Real Madrid exists as a club and can grow on the basis of organic growth, you know, and all the sort of, you know, the dull things you'd expect me to come out with. And the opposition said, I'm going to sign Haaland, Harry Kane and Kylian Mbappe. Who do you think is going to get voted in? So, you know, it's unfortunately the presidential model that we see taking place in Barcelona becomes one of populism, and populism normally involves spending money that you don't have.
Mm. One of the other Super League rebels, Spurs, are delaying the repayment of their £175 million taxpayer-backed loan for another year.
Yes. So this was the one of the COVID facilities that was set up by the Bank of England. You're only paying 0.5% interest a year. So that works out as £875,000 for a full year for Spurs. Spurs does have other loans which pay much higher rates of interest. And that they are entitled to kick it down the road. And I think when we discussed when they initially took out the loan that this was going to likely to happen, because they've not got the return of fans taking place yet. So therefore, they do have those cash flow challenges. The trouble is that the money is specifically for, you know, day-to-day costs. And if you go into the small print of Spurs accounts, it reveals that they've got a £97 million net transfer spend this season, which has taken them to the heady heights of seventh, is it, in the Premier League?
Mm-hmm.
And it just doesn't look good. But from a legal point of view, they're perfectly entitled to do it. Other companies in other industries have done it as well. So it's again, you know, football does get a lot of scrutiny. It doesn't look great from a neutral's perspective.
Mm. It's like a proper old-timey pod today, Kieran. We started off with Derby and now we've got a Bury story. Their ground is up for sale.
Yes. So Bury Football Club is in administration, and the administrator, Stephen Whiteglass, who has twice been charged by his own profession on misconduct charges. And the reason why I say that is somebody that used to work in the accounting profession, it's unusual to get charged. You know, it's unusual to get up before the beak, you know, once, because you know, nobody likes dibbing in your own profession, regardless of the profession. Nobody. So he's twice been censured by his own profession. He's put the freehold up for sale, which I think is actually the right thing to do, because ultimately he's got to pay the creditors of Bury Football Club, and the stadium is the biggest asset. But now the creditors, according to the most recent report, are £15.2 million. Steve Dale, described by some as a wank puffin, whatever that is, has been described as being uncooperative with the administrator, but would appear to have some form of links with some of the creditors. And I think the concern of Bury fans or other people who've investigated this is that are some of those creditors' figures perhaps a little bit unrealistically high? You know, trying to get to the bottom of things is actually quite difficult. The one positive from this, because ultimately, you know, as a football fan, I would like to see football being played at Gig Lane by a football club representing Bury. Yeah, and I'll say no more than that. We're not getting involved in the disputes, but there is the potential for Gig Lane to be treated as what we refer to as a community interest asset. And if that is the case, Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, did talk about having some form of what was referred to as matched funding, which is, in my understanding, again, I may be wrong on this, is that for every pound you put in as sort of a community club or community organisation, the government will match it pound for pound. So it could lead to if the people involved can settle their differences, because ultimately they all love the same thing, is my view. Settle differences and try to put together some form of case for being able to buy back Gig Lane, get effectively 50% funding from the government, and then perhaps things could move forwards. But it's not easy. Unfortunately, views on both sides of the divide seem to have become entrenched.
There's nothing better than hearing a grown-up man use the phrase "wank puffing" in the middle of a serious story. Because I wank puffing just sounds like you're out of breath in a very specific way. Not with Finlay in the room. Do we know why Mr. Wiseglass has twice been censured by the accounting profession?
If you go on to the websites of the regulators, it does it. It's sort
not
of
gonna happen.
Just a bit of sloppy work is the politest way I can describe it, and not in the same way as wank puffing.
Yeah. Okay. Rochdale Supporters Trust, just down the road, of course, called an extraordinary general meeting in relation to the potential removal of two directors.
Yes. There have been, we've mentioned in passing Rochdale on a couple of occasions. They did have some investment effectively from the US via an organization called Smarter Scout, who were looking to get more involved with Rochdale. They have a sort of tentative relationship for a couple of years, and they withdrew their relationship. And the guy in charge just made sort of reference to, and I quote, serious internal issues. Now, the Rochdale Supporters Trust, who do seem to be quite active, they are unhappy with the board of directors. And they are proposing to hold an extraordinary general meeting to remove Chief Executive David Bottomley and also another one of the directors called Graham Rollinson. And I had some contact with a Rochdale fan who described David Bottomley is the Monty Burns and Graham Rollinson is his Smithers. Now.
Great, a good description. Okay,
good description.
Yeah.
So the Supporters Trust it has, in addition, is apparently the existing chairman is expected to leave, and I think they had a bit of faith in the chairman, and therefore that's one positive that appears to be going. They were concerned that a contract was offered to the manager, which didn't appear to actually go through sort of any public scrutiny. And that there's in general just a breakdown of the relationship between the boardroom and the fan base, and it's not the first time that's happened in recent weeks, and we've seen what's happened at Old Trafford and Chelsea and all of the big six clubs, and certainly at a time of when the game has suffered, and you would expect and you would hope that there would be improved engagement and communication, it looks as if some of the boards of clubs really haven't helped themselves. Whenever I've had a dispute with anyone or anything, the best way to resolve it is to talk to people, and you actually find you've potentially got some common ground, and the areas that you can't agree on, then you can start to move forwards if you act in a positive manner. But it looks sadly as if there is not a good relationship between the board of directors and the Supporters Trust.
Yes, and there's another EGM coming up as well in relation to a vote of no confidence at the National League.
Yes, and this vote is taking place on the 26th of May, which apparently is the very last date at which it could have been convened. The 26th of May is a is a sad memory day for me, because that's the date in 1983 when Manchester United beat Brighton and Hove Albion 4-0 in the FA Cup replay. Mm-hmm. Not that it still scarred me, mainly due to the fact that I was at Manchester University at the time. I had an exam the following day. I went down on the train from Manchester to the match. And on the way back, having an exam, it was the days when you had overnight trains, because they were the mail trains. So it was taking me 5.5 hours to get back from London to Manchester. And I locked myself in the toilet to do some revision for my exam that following morning. And I left my calculator in the toilet. So when I went to do the exam, I had to do it with no calculator. And it did really badly, and it cost me my 2-1. So I'm still bitter 38 years later, Kevin.
I'll just pause for a second while I get the world's smallest violin. how did you do an accountancy exam without a calculator?
Well, you do it in the head, don't you?
Okay, fair enough. Yeah.
That's what. Well, get out pens and paper and having to do sums in my head, which isn't necessarily easy when you're trying to add up or multiply a dozen figures at a time.
Yeah, I just like the fact as well. Any other football team, any other train, people go, "What is he doing in that toilet for 5.5 hours?" They go, "He's revising." Oh, it's Kieran, is it? Fair enough.
Yes. So this this is the proposal by a series of clubs in the National League to have a vote of no confidence in the board of the National League itself. I think clubs in National League North and National League South will have breakout rooms on Zoom. This is a really advanced for the National League, isn't it?
Mm.
Because they have 4 votes each, is my understanding. And the clubs in the National League itself has 1 vote. Now, I think there's 23 clubs, or it could be down to 20. I'm not quite sure of Dover Athletic's status in that meeting. But the clubs in the National League will have 1 vote each, and National League North and National League South will have 4 votes. And if you don't attend the meeting, you will be fined. So, the National League is bringing out the big guns as far as this. Yeah, perhaps if they had been a bit more on the ball earlier, this vote wouldn't be taking place. So nothing's good's going to come out of this. Lots of people are very upset. Again, lack of communication, lack of engagement. This is how we end up.
Mm. Liverpool FC women's team, Kieran, have reduced their losses in 2019-20 thanks to a big increase in revenue, which is good news, but seems a bit counterintuitive in these days.
The reason why Liverpool's money, Liverpool's women's team's money has gone up, it went up by 60%.
Wow. Brilliant.
It's not due to gate receipts. Gate receipts are still tiny, and actually this isn't necessarily a bad thing. What quite a few of the women's team are doing is that they are letting people in on very, 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 very cheap prices to attract and expand the audience and see the benefits of that. The women's, certainly, the coverage of the women's game has increased. The quality of the game is pretty damn good as well.
Absolutely.
Chelsea have got a potential quadruple coming up. But Liverpool did manage to reduce their losses, because whilst their income went up, their wages did go up as well. But they're less than half of the wages of Manchester City. They are a very small fraction of the wages of Chelsea. And they were relegated at the end of last season. So it was a bit of a contrast in terms of what was happening. Liverpool, the men's team won the Premier League and the women's team were relegated. And I sort of did a bit of nosing around. As you know, I work in Liverpool, and sort of the vibes I got from talking to people surrounding the women's team was the FSG, the American commodities broker owned people in charge of Liverpool, They were prepared to spend as much money as it takes, as far as the men's team were concerned, but you know, literally trying to get paper clips for the women's team for the stationery was proving to be a real challenge. So it was a really tough job trying to progress the women's team when sort of computer says no is the standard answer to trying to make sure that the facility is being used. And there was no criticism of Jurgen Klopp or Jordan Henderson. Yeah, they were really supportive.
Yeah.
But actually trying to improve things on a day-to-day basis in terms of training and facilities was difficult. And that ultimately impacts upon what you can do on the pitch and the Cypress Renegade. And it's such a shame because, you know, if you take a look at the WSL, we've got Chelsea, the two Manchester teams, Arsenal, Spurs, Everton, you had Liverpool as well. Yeah, there's a lot of potential derbies or local matches taking place there, and now one side is out of the division. Yeah, because according to my sources, they weren't really given a financial backing.
That's not right. A couple more news stories, Kieran, before our brilliant interview. Not content with wanting a statue of themselves outside the ground, Wigan's administrators have now published a list of reasons why they're so great.
Yes, the administrator's latest report came to Companies House, and it starts off with an executive summary, which is so full of self-congratulation as to be, just absolutely staggering. You know, the first thing is, and this is somebody that's got a Word document and clearly has just worked out how to use the tick symbol. So it starts off with big tick, survival of the club, brackets achieved. Appeal, avoid a further 15-point deduction for not meeting specific financial requirements of the EFL, achieved. Paid staff and wages for June 2020, achieved. So that all of these, absolutely amazing. You look at this, my word, what a wonderful bunch of guys these administrators are. Some reason it didn't mention all of the redundancies, tick, achieved. Didn't mention the fact that the fees charged by the administrator have increased by £865,000 compared to the initial estimate that was achieved. And they have got their one-third uplift agreed with the creditors, so it looks like it's averaging £502 an hour. As we know, that the strange owner, the former owner, who based in Hong Kong, a guy called Al Young, trying to work out why he A, bought the club, and B, put the club into administration a few weeks later, was very weird. But they don't appear to have a spell checker. So it actually says in the executive summary, and this has been lodged at Companies House. So remember, these people are paying themselves £502 an hour on average. They said resolve position with the Hong Kong based owner. So they can't even spell a four letter word. It's just unfortunately, if you're going to do this work, and I used to do this work back in the day, you're dealing with people who are uncertain about their futures. You're dealing with people who are distressed. You're dealing with creditors who have supplied goods and services in good faith and who are, and they're saying, well, they're going to get 25 pence in the pound. That means that they're not going to get 75% in the pound. So, let's not just be too smug. You deal with people with compassion and decency, and you don't go around saying, we're absolutely brilliant. And by the way, we're charging £2.2 million for the privilege.
Finally, Kieran, if we were doing this pod in 1974, I'd probably have a hangover from stealing my dad's barley wine. You'd be talking about your first junior spreadsheet, and I'd be saying, can we hurry up? I've got a date with Susan Strengths on Magpie. But it's always my favourite, Susan Strengths on Magpie. But Manchester United's accounts from the 1973-74 season have been published. and they make for very interesting reading, it says here.
Well, yeah, it's one of these really bizarre things. I get updates from Company's House on every single football club in England and Scotland.
1974?
And
it's
for
not
some
an update,
reason,
is it?
Well, some reason the 1974 figures got sent in. I've no idea why. It's absolutely nuts.
Have you tried turning it off and turning it on again, Kieran? See if it updates itself.
This could be part of the Glazers' master plan to divert attention from them losing their sponsors. I don't know. But some of the numbers are just incredible. In 1974, Kevin, Manchester United made from television companies the grand total of £2,839.
Holy mother of God, really?
And that compares to £241 million in 2019.
Wow.
The highest paid player was on £330 a week. And that was the only player that was paid more than £30,000 a year
Wow.
in the whole of Manchester United.
Do we know who that was?
No, I was trying to work that out myself. I mean, would that have been...
Oh, someone odd like Brian Greenough or someone like that. That's interesting.
It could be Martin Buchan.
Could be Martin Buchan. And that TV money, that's presumably just the BBC for showing them on Match of the Day, is it, presumably?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. 2,800 for the whole year. So those, you know, and sort of, you know, linking it back to the people behind Super League who say, you know, that footballers needs to be rescued by these multi-billionaires, they don't know how lucky they are. What they're totally incapable of doing is that, you know, to quote Sir Alan Sugar, when it comes in, it goes out like prune juice. What you got to do, it's not a case of getting more money into the game of football. It's not spending it stupidly.
Well, old-time Manchester United links us nicely into our interview this week. And, dear listener, our interview this week is a little bit longer than normal, but that's for a reason, because it was really interesting and very good, and I'm sure you'll enjoy it as much as we did. As earlier this year, you may have seen on BT Sport a very perceptive and rather sad documentary in parts called Ours that looked at notions of identity, belonging and fan ownership in clubs outside the Premier League. It was written and presented by award-winning journalist and sports writer Michael Calvin, who's also just released a book called Whose Game Is It Anyway? So many meaty topics to talk about, many things that coincide with what we want to do in this pod. But first of all, I wanted to ask him about the sort of irrational football dislike that I am so fond of. Michael, it's lovely to have you on the pod. Thank you for joining us. You were a childhood Watford fan, but the big question is, do you still hate Leeds?
Well, hate is always a strong word. I'm extremely unimpressed by them. Let's put it like that. That childhood angst was basically caused by sock tags, carpet bowls, you know, all these sort of accoutrements of Dom Revy's perfectionism. It just, you know, even as a little kid, was, you know, I was sort of 11 at the time, and you only had to look at my bedroom, which I share with three brothers, to know that I wasn't the tidiest thing in the world. So, yeah, this whole sort of prissy, we're perfectionists really got to me. And that was why, you know, as I talk about in the book, I got TB when I was 16 and created my own fantasy league. And to make room for Watford, who were in the third division at the time, I excluded Leeds United from the 1973-74 first division. And it didn't really cost me a wink of sleep.
Listen, Michael, any book that mentions the Shoot League Ladders and Oliver Twist in the first few pages is absolutely fine by me. It's a wonderful book. But why this book and why particularly now?
Well, it was written at the height of the pandemic, and I suppose that was a time for all of us of self-reflection, and privately, quietly, I suppose we were all looking for a bit of meaning and a bit of reevaluation. And for me, as the lockdown was coming in, I'd fallen out of love with football in a way that, you know, probably presaged the, you know, the Super League that we've all been, you know, entertained by over the last few weeks. I just, it was the innate cynicism, the relentless commercialism, the bloodless elitism of top level football. It really got to me. And it took the death of my father-in-law from COVID early on in the lockdown. He was in a care home in Devon. And he was also suffering from an accelerated form of vascular dementia. And about 4 or 5 days before he passed away, you know, obviously we were in that awful void of not being able to go and see him or touch him. So we communicated via FaceTime, really. And my wife asked him, apropos of nothing, really, he was a mad Watford fan throughout his life. And, you know, she asked him, you know, what do you remember of him? And it was amazing that he had this sort of burst of clarity where he spoke about being, he was basically, he was the 11, 12-year-old kid again. Mm. And he talked about walking through the terrace streets of West Watford, you know, the Saturday mint, that anticipation of the game, playing in the morning. His dad used to watch him play football in the morning. And they would go into the sweet shop. It was his sort of weekly treat or fortnightly treat. And that anticipation of going into the ground. And, you know, what's always entranced me about football, it's a sensual experience, isn't it? It's the sounds, yeah. It's the smells, it's the sights, and it's that communal thing. And, you know, going into a big ground, Watford at that time was, you know, it was about 10 years from removed from being a gravel pit. So you can get an idea of the bowl that it would have been. And that really struck me. And when he passed away, it sort of tied in, because when we were looking at his belongings, we went into the garden shed, and right in the corner, there was a wooden box that had been there for years. And when we opened it, there it was his father's box, and full of woodworking tools. But also on the inside of the box were three fixture lists from the 1932-33 Watford season, the first team, the reserve team, and a London midweek league team. It was a pretty standard season, as it turned out. All the scores were annotated in pencil, obviously by his dad. And, you know, the teams were basically mid-table teams, third division south with the first team. But there was a small thumbnail photograph of a young player above the midweek league team. And I just wondered who he was. And so delved into the history of the club at that time, tried to find out a little bit more about the culture of the club, but also why, you know, why was this, who was this guy, and why was he there? And it was when we were also looking through some of my father-in-law's belongings, he was a Royal Marine Commando during the war. Mm. And we came across a team photo from the 1945-46 season, which had him in the front row. Because basically they didn't disband the commandos until about a year after the war. And it looked really similar to the young player in that photograph. So, you know, went back again. It couldn't have been him at that particular time, because he was 11 years old. Mm. So, and it's one of these mysteries. But what the one thing that really stuck with me is that was intimacy. That was an intimate thing, that it was a sign of a bond between a father and a son. Now I'll never know whether that was him in the photograph. Mm. And in a way, isn't that more fitting, probably? But you know, I went to the club and said, look, have you got any record of an Oliver Goss even having a trial with you just before the war or something like that, where he would have been 16, 17? Yeah. But so we'll never know. But that really struck me, and I thought, well, those themes of identity, of family, of intimacy, they were some of the things that really attracted me to football in the first place. Mm. As a kid. And so, well, why don't I go through my own experiences, my own life, in football and in sport in general, and try and see if that sort of journey, if you like, will trigger those feelings, those emotions, those memories, which will basically sweep, almost cleanse me of some of the modern stuff that's gone on.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
It's strange. One of the things I love about the book is that idea of triggering memories, because I started to think about the first time I went to Watford as a Palace fan and being bowled over by the fact there are allotments there.
Yeah. We used to bunk in, and at the stage there were some allotments behind the rookery end there. Yeah. We used to be able to bunk in.
Yeah, because I remember a mate of mine going, because he said, "Where are we? Shrewsbury? It's a countryside. What's that about?" But also, I think there's a thing, Palace and Watford, because they're similar sort of clubs. I think, oddly enough, with Kieran being a Brighton fan, which is a source of terrible, terrible disappointment for a South London boy, but Brighton, Palace and Watford, I think, played each other more than any other teams in the old Third Division South. And I always, Watford was sort of a London team, but not a London team.
Yeah.
So it's sort of the same with Palace. My dad used to get furious when Watford were on the big match, because he said they should get their own program. They're not London. But listen, as I said in my introduction, Michael, we'll be here all day if we just start talking about some of the brilliant stories in the book. But I was particularly struck, because your book chimes with a lot of the things that we talk about in this pod, but I was particularly struck by your description of being in the same room as Margaret Thatcher just after Heysel, probably the darkest day of English football, when she was haranguing journalists and basically describing English football fans as subhuman. And I was also struck by the fact that you seem to think that government attitudes haven't really changed that much towards football fans 36 years later.
No, when you think about it, what was their default reaction at the start of the pandemic? It was to, try and push the modern generation of footballer into a guilt trip. Mm. They were patsies, weren't they? Or they thought they could use them as patsies. And that was spectacularly ill-judged. When you think about, the one thing that I look about modern football, and there are still things that I despise about it, one of the things that have come through very, very strongly in the last year or so is we are developing a new generation of athlete activists. When you've been around as long as we have, Kevin, you think, well, okay, if you're looking at sportsmen or women who make a social impact, you really usually are drawn to North America. So, we're thinking of Tommy Smith in the '68 Olympics, Ali with his campaigning, his pacifism. More recently, Colin Kaepernick. You've got LeBron James being active in the presidential election recently. But we've now got our own generation here of very wealthy young athletes, but they're not feckless, as the government were trying to imply.
Yeah,
they're socially engaged because, and there's a really weird sort of dichotomy here, because you've got these young players, multimillionaires, they're treated as commodities, and in essence, they are they're the chief execs of their own multinational corporations. Mm. But also, they're closer to the streets than people realize. And there are consistent factors in the way that they've been brought up. And so if you think about the two probably most prominent social campaigners, if I can put it like that, Raheem Sterling, because he made a huge and very welcome intervention in the anti-racist debate, and obviously Marcus Rashford. Both guys brought up by very strong single mothers who kept large families together and worked themselves to the bone, and but also demanded values of their sons. Mm. And those values have actually been, I think, emphasized over the last year or so. If you think about someone like Marcus Rashford, he has been the most cogent, empathetic, and effective political campaigner that we've had in the UK over the last 12 to 15 months. That he has created that sense of social awareness that politicians really almost shy away from these days, because, you know, they don't want to get involved in that sort of stuff because it obviously will reflect badly on them. Mm. And there's a little bit of, you know, I also, you know, was a council house kid myself, you know, hugely fortunate to have been, you know, I punted myself around the world, you know, I've worked in about 80 odd countries. I always, what I loved about football is that, the whole cliche, isn't it? The working man's ballet and all that stuff. But it is a working class sport. And as well, the book that probably influenced me more than anything was The Football Man by Arthur Hopcraft. And he talks about football as working class communion. And those guys are coming from that sort of background. And, you know, just as politicians or Thatcher's children or Thatcher's grandchildren, whatever you want to say, just as they dismiss football fans as Neanderthals in some sort of like class conscious swipe, these guys are proving that the game itself, for all its faults, does contain good people. And that's why, again, in the book, I suppose, what I wanted to try and do after looking back at what I've been fortunate enough to do and experience and the people I've met and the people who have inspired me, but it's also I'm trying to look for the people. I'm trying to look for the good in the game, if you like, because I can't fall back in love with it if I don't find those people. Mm. And that's what I try and do. And, because there are some really, really good people out there doing really good things in a bad situation. You know, it's as Gareth Southgate says, you know, it's a great game, shit industry. Mm. And it is. And actually, Gareth Southgate, Palace legend, of course. That's when I first met him when he was there.
Yeah.
He was born in the hospital overlooking Watford's ground.
Yeah.
In the year that we got to the FA Cup semi-final. And his uncle, Mick, used to live at the end of our road. So we go back, the England manager and I. We've got some sort of like, you know, psychological bond together or something.
Again, that's one of the things I love about football, that sort of detail in the book. But the politicians thing is this. I mean, we've spoken about this two instances. Michael Gove saying, well, football can't come back because we can trust the fans in the stadium, but we can't trust them not to get drunk on planes and hug each other. And also Matt Hancock in the first couple of weeks, literally throwing the biggest of dead cats onto the table when he was being asked about PPE and the lack of it, saying, well, Premier League footballers get paid a lot of money, don't they? Which is like totally. Yeah. But I noticed as well, is that one of the reasons why you're slightly disparaging about some modern journalists as well, in particular the ones who stirred up what you called the manufactured controversy about Mason Greenwood and Phil Foden when they broke quarantine? But, and you were particularly concerned about the effect that sort of thing has on modern players.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, in that particular instance, you know, one of the things, and I think we have to be really real in looking at our own business, you know, young black footballers are subjected to persistent and consistent racism on a daily basis because of who they are, their profile, and, you know, there were certain elements of the way that that story was treated, which did have, quite disturbing connotations. And I think, we've seen it also in the way that, you know, someone like The Raheem Sterling has been treated. You know, there was a piece about Marcus Rashford, and it was almost there was a particular piece about Marcus Rashford where, especially when you're online, the first thing that makes the impact and sets the tone of any piece is the photograph of the guy or the subject. And, you know, if you look at Marcus Rashford, he's got quite a soft face, hasn't he? He's quite a smiley guy. And what they use this glaring picture of the guy, the kid in the hoodie, you know. And so it's basically, it was written in 58 point, this is what we're dealing with here. And it was his 1.6 million mansion sort of stuff. And that's what I find really, we have to call that out, even if it's against our own trade, because I don't believe in, I was brought up in Fleet Street, that was a completely different era. And, part one of the sort of the credo was dog doesn't eat dog.
Mm-hmm.
There is still an element of, really old fashioned, prejudice, really, I suppose, is the best word. And having said that, I think it's right that I should actually also big up the industry because, it's a hugely, positive time for journalism in particular. There are some brilliant female journalists coming through, people like Katie Wire, Susie Rack. You've got some really good young black journalists coming through. Art de Roche at the Athletic, in particular, I think is going to be, an absolute. He's going to be at the forefront of the profession for a while. So, there is a lot of good in journalism at the moment, and there's a lot of really quite important stuff being written. Mm. Things like. Child abuse. But equally, there are still some throwback stuff. There's some still, we talked about Neanderthals as fans. Well, there's a few Neanderthal pieces being written still.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking a lot about your documentary Hours recently, talking of important stuff. And the reason I was thinking about it is every time I heard Ian Wright or Gary Neville say Arsenal fans, United fans want their club back, I thought, no, what most of them want is to be in the Champions League final. And your documentary started with fans who really want their club back, Bury fans, and it went on from there to explore various options of fan ownership. And it just struck me, I was just so annoyed. The irony that it took a Super League to galvanise Sky and BT into becoming friends of the fans. But that righteous anger from Sky wasn't there when Bury was going out of business. It wasn't there when Macclesfield was going out of business. So it's so important that documentaries like yours can give those fans a voice. And it broke my heart watching those Bury fans. Because twice it could have happened to Palace. Kieran knows it could have happened to Brighton. Watford have been in all sorts of... And I can't imagine what life would be without my football club. And just hearing those people articulate that the one guy talking about his routine every day, as you mentioned in the book, that if the cab's not there by 2 minutes past one, his dad says, that's it, he's not coming, and you've got to be in the same spot in the social club. And it's important that people like you document the voice of these fans, because otherwise they're just going to become a footnote in other books in 10, 20 years' time.
Well, that struck me really, very much. I went up to Bury. It was part of the research for the book, really. Mm. And probably like you, Kev, I wanted to find out what it's like for a fan when he or she loses their football club.
Yeah.
And I'd sort of been, one of these sort of like, speed dates you have on social media. There's a guy on there whose handle was James is a Bury fan. So I thought, well, that's not a bad place to start. So I got in touch with him. He's a great guy called James Bentley. And we met on platform 2 of Bolton Street Station in Bury, which is where the steam trains go and they go down the valley. And they've also got a bar. And this was in the early stage of the pandemic, but It was socially distant, so it was all okay. In fact, our nearest neighbours were two. There were a couple, and this was about 11 o'clock in the morning on a Saturday morning because I was going to the Bury AFC game in the afternoon. And these two people were on this trestle table, and they had the biggest bowls of lager I've ever seen. There's like three. There had to be three or four pints in each of these glasses. It was ridiculous, like a bucket. And I'm thinking, 11 o'clock in the morning, fair play, that's not bad. You know, that could be a lively afternoon. But anyway, so I talked to James, and I was blown away because I'd never heard anyone articulate that link, that really human flesh and blood bond that you have with your football club so well. He talked so empathetically about what being a fan meant. And as you said, Kev, you know, that whole thing of walking to the ground, knowing the cracks in each pavement, all that sort of stuff. And that gave me the idea for the documentary. I thought, well, and also, if, you know, for listeners who've not seen it, if not, why not? But rather than, you know, these things, as we know, you know, usually like the narrator or the presenter will start off and set the tone and everything else. And I thought, right, I want James to set the tone of the documentary. And I always work transparently with my subjects. And, you know, obviously I got a transcript of the chat we had that day and sent it to him because I'm going to say, look, this is going to form the basis of the chapter I'm going to write in the book. And I then said, look at that. And I basically took out pretty much verbatim 2 minutes worth of him talking about what it meant, and we used that at the start of the film. We went around to his house, and our sound man was brilliant. He put towels everywhere around the front room, and James, you know, he was quite good. He did it in a couple of takes, but I thought that was really important because also that day there were so many things that chimed with me and going back to my father-in-law. So, for instance, when we talk about family, on that that very platform in 1914, his great-grandfather, a guy called Thomas Watts, went to war, went to the First World War in 1914. He didn't get back until 1919 because they found him in a prisoner of war camp in Germany. So there's family, and his great granddad passed on the love of football. So indirectly, his great granddad got James involved in football because it, you know, it was a family thing that you went to the football on the Saturday, you know. But also on that station, that was where the Bury team in 1903 went to Crystal Palace for the FA Cup final, which they won 6-0. As a Palace fan, I'm sure you can tell me who they beat. Charlton, Ryan Charles?
It was, yeah.
there's a bit of enthusiasm in your voice there for a second. And so, that's, you know, that's civic pride. You know, that was 118 years ago, and that those, you know, local heroes, if you like, are still remembered. So that is what football does. It gives you a collective cause. So all these things were fitting into place, and that's why, you know, then I sort of, you know, I wanted to look at the whole concept of fan-run clubs because, you know, sometimes I think we're in a privileged position and we're very close to the game in many ways. And certainly, you know, what I found in sort of moving from newspapers into doing books full-time is that when you do books, you have a, you know, I spent far too many years as either a chief sports writer or a columnist on the Nationals, where, you know, I've got 1,000 words max, maybe 1,200, to actually look at an issue or an individual. A book gives me 100,000 words to really get underneath it a bit and get underneath the bonnet and just have a little look at it. And so I wanted to do that with fans, but I like the idea of doing it through you know, a documentary process, pros and cons, but also when you look at it, part of the process of the last year or so is that reevaluation. I got quite close, you know, I work quite closely within football, and if I was fed up with it, if I'd had enough of it, presumably other people have. And again, I think partly the whole Super League thing might even, you know, emphasize this. I think fan-run clubs, or certainly fan-influenced clubs, will become much more important, perhaps influential, because, you know, I look at the way that that supporters are still dismissed, like even today, right? We're talking on a day where Spurs have offered their fans a place on the board. Well, you know, neutered. They'll be neutered. But also, they basically showed themselves in the true light by trying to attract the support, attack the supporters' trust. So basically, we've had all this staged, managed contrition. The people, the type of people who produced the Super League plan, have got no empathy for the game. They've got no love of the game. It's, you know, they're in the widgets business. They've got no idea of the social importance of the game. And that's where I think people are getting fed up with that. And also, there's an economic element to this. I've got a mate who's a West Ham fan. And, you know, we were talking, you know, 6-8 weeks ago, something like that. And he's saying, well, for me to take my lad to the London Stadium, well, I call it the Olympic Stadium, just to get up Karen Brady's nose, to be honest. But
I call it Upton Park, just to get up my mate's nose.
Basically. Oh, absolutely, yeah. The bowling what?
The bowling, yeah.
And he said, well, if I go down there, you know, and this is pre-pandemic, obviously, but if I'm going to go back, get a train down, a few beers for the game, bit to eat. That day cost me £250.
Yeah.
Now, he's just moved, as it happens, and he's moved close to a non-league team, Barton Rovers. And he said, well, if I go around the road to Barton Rovers, I don't know what it's to get in. I think it's £6-7, something like that. I can have a few beers with my mates. I can change ends at halftime if I fancy it. I'm very close to the pitch. It's, you know, I know what's going on. I can hear people. I can see them. Why do I want to spend all my day watching a game from afar in a horrible stadium, a soulless stadium that I don't like, and it's probably not really ours. It doesn't feel like ours, like Upton Park did. Why do I need that? So, you know, he will go to Barton Rovers instead of West Ham. He said, look, if I want to watch West Ham, I don't stop supporting them. I just watch them on TV.
Yeah. It's one of the things we've talked about on the pod a lot. I think the big winners out of all this could well be non-league football, which is, you know, I mean, I'll be going to see Sutton and Carl Shorten more often than I used to, just because I feel it's my duty to now. And it's interesting, all it took for Spurs to suggest fans' voices on the board was a spectacularly misguided attempt to break football to make more money for them. Michael, I'm very aware we as a pod are more the 1,200 words rather than the book length, unfortunately, and there's already lots of things I'm not going to have time to ask you. But I just, there's a couple of things I want to put to you just to finish, and I think they're both positive things. You're a very big fan of a fan of the pod, and we love him to bits, Andy Holt, the chair of Accrington Stanley. You talk about club owners. I know he doesn't like to be called the club owner, but club owners who still have the love of the game, and Andy Holt's one of them. He's one of the good guys, and I particularly like to quote in the book, which I'd like you to tell us about, the fruit machine quote.
Yes. Well, basically, we were talking about, we were almost like prefacing the arrival of the Super League, but we were talking about, we were in the porter cabin that acts as John Coleman's office just before a game, Andy was in the corner, and Cody came in and gave him yet another bottle of Estrella. So he was he was having a few beers. But we were talking about the championship and, you know, what an absolute casino it was. And he was saying, well, look, if I had, if I put a slot machine in the middle of Burnley High Street and said, you can win £200 million. He said, there would be a riot because I would bankrupt everyone who tried to play the machine. And that's what football, that's what, this is where Kieran knows, we were talking off air just beforehand about Derby County.
Yeah.
They are symptomatic of that lunatic surge to get the Premier League TV money. And it is interesting that I don't think it would be a bad, my instinctive reaction, and I think it's probably shared by Andy, when I heard about the Super League and, it confirmed everything that we knew was going to come anyway, I thought, well, just, okay, off you go, chaps, toddle off, fine, we don't need you. We could actually recreate this game, and because life over the last year has been accelerated, but it's been slowed down. If it doesn't sound mad, So basically, things are never going to be as different, never going to be the same as what they were 15 months ago, 18 months ago. So football's got a unique chance here to reset, not just in terms of the spirit of it, but almost you can do the structure of this. What's to stop you? Reiterating your belief in that, the democracy and the meritocracy of the pyramid. You don't need these people who, you don't need to assuage them. I think your chairman, Kev, has been very good on Super League. And, just frankly, we don't need the attitudes and the individuals who basically have brought the Super League to a head, because frankly they're not good. We've had all this ghost written contrition, haven't we? Which is the gaps between the lines. You can read into it. You can read their contempt for the fans within those pieces. You don't need those people in the game. Let's try and start. I'm not saying this is going to happen because the one thing, when you've been around a few years in newspapers or in sport, real politics usually works. But I'd love to see a spiritual rebirth of the game out of this. Will it happen? No, probably not. Mm. But we can dream, can't we?
We can. I think I'm more optimistic than you. I think there are positive changes afoot. And I'd like to finish on this because one of the most interesting aspects of the documentary and the book were a group of people that I think I knew as much about as you did before you met them, and that's the Sidemen at Leighton Orient. Tell us a little bit about them and why you were so enthusiastic about them.
Well, the one thing I didn't want to come across in the book and the film is something, it was better in my day and all that sort of stuff.
Well, it was really, but yeah.
It was, of course it was. Yeah. the thing that really struck me about, we were actually filming Hashtag United at the time.
Yeah.
Again, a brilliant piece, Spencer, the guy who runs it, I'm looking at him. And I'm thinking, this is the sort of guy who should be running football.
Yeah.
Not the Clarks of this world and people like that. This is someone who understands modern business principles. He's in tune with an audience that football doesn't really look at. And so when we were filming that, one of the hashtag guys said to me, he said, you should go and see these guys called the Sidemen. I said, who? I said, I've never heard of them. Yeah. And, for listeners' purposes, these are seven guys. They got together 5-6 years ago. They're YouTubers. They have a total YouTube following of 110 million.
Well,
and their videos, which tend to be, football, mates asking about, football challenges, all that sort of stuff. Those videos over the last 5 years, I think, have had 26 billion views.
Wow.
which is ridiculous, isn't it? And those numbers absolutely blew me away. So we found them, and because they'd done us a strategic deal with Leighton Orient, who actually, to be honest, is one of my favourite clubs. It's always got that warmth about it when I've been there in the past, you know. And I go back to the days of like John Chidozie and people like that. But speaking to them, I spoke to a guy, one of them called Toby Brown. What he's known as Toby Jizzle. he actually went through a stage where he was trying to get away with being called Toby Lerone, but you know. So I thought, well, you know, good. But he's again the sort of person who should be involved in football.
Yeah.
And so he was basically saying, well, you know, we're local lads. You know, sadly, you know, like most Londoners, he's a Man United fan, but he was really good about what the club give them, which is obviously that, you know, they in Brisbane Road they now can film their videos because they've got so big. They used to just do it in the park, but now they get mobbed if they go and do it in the park. But it was the way that Leighton Orient used them and their foresight. A guy called Josh Stevens, who's their commercial guy, who comes from the music business, so he understands. He's got that link into you know the newer generations, the generation Zs, and how they will grow with a team or with a club or with a brand or whatever you want to call it. And I found it fascinating because I'm looking at that and I'm thinking about the numbers. And it's interesting that Nigel Travis, who is the chairman, who basically, you know, led the consortium that took over from Bocchetti, who was that, you know, that head case who sacked about, I think, was it 12 managers or something ridiculous? When you looked at Nigel, he was in the States. He was in Boston when we did a sort of a Zoomy type interview from the ground with him. And he's someone who's worked in the corporate culture in, you know, high levels in North America, and he was talking about, well, even, you know, the direct and immediate consequence of working with someone like the Sidemen is, one, it globalizes the fan base because, you know, someone in Boise, Idaho, who might watch the soccer videos, will think, well, what's Leighton Orient? So they might go on. So that, you know, that might be. You know, so the boy in Boise, Idaho might want to try and stream a Leighton Orient game, see what the fuss is about, or buy a shirt or whatever, you know? So that's the future there. A younger audience, a more diverse audience. Mm. And the thing that Nigel says is, look, football isn't a 3 p.m. till 20 to 5 experience. Mm. It's a 24/7 experience. And when you think about it and think about it as a fan, it is an immersive experience. That was the one thing that really struck me about doing, you know, the book and film, is that when you talk to people in the grounds, it's an expression of commonality, of friendship. And that, I think, is something that, but we've lost, we might get back. But certainly the Sidemen told me that football has to change with the times, and it doesn't mean sacrificing tradition or, you know, because life evolves, and life has evolved really quickly over the last 15 to 18 months. Mm. And I suspect we will be feeling the impact of the Super League aligned to the social earthquake of COVID. We'll be feeling that impact over the next 10 to 15, 20 years. Mm. It'd be really interesting to see how and where football is in, say, 2030 or even 2040, because it's not going to be the same. Because it's going to go, the elitism, that's a runaway train now. That's going to happen anyway. You know, I just don't see why you should appease these people anymore. They're going to do it. If they don't do it next year, they'll do it the year after or the year after that. You know, probably tie it in with a TV contract somewhere.
Mm.
So let's rediscover what we're about, I think, is probably the message from both the book and the film.
Michael, all I can hope is that, please God, in 30 years' time, all of us are somewhere moaning about Palace, Brighton, Watford still being rubbish, still trying to get back into whatever the Premier League is called. It's been a pleasure to talk to you, Michael. I could have carried on talking all day, but unfortunately our producer, Guy, who you met, gets very antsy if we start going into golden overtime, which we've done already, and we've got a pod to do off the back of this. So it's been a pleasure to talk to you, Michael. Best of luck with the book, which we will give details of at the end. And the documentary is still available. I think if you go to BT Sport website, the documentary Hours is available there, and I would urge anybody who's interested in the future of football and in models of fan ownership, and I know most of our listeners are, to check that out. So nice to meet you, Michael. Good luck with everything in the future.
Thanks very much, pal. Thank you.
I mean, Kieran, that's, you're talking about three men of a certain vintage who share very much the same view about football. It's interesting as well that, as he mentioned, we talked to him on the same day that Spurs suddenly have said, yeah, we're going to put fans on the board now. We've always planned to do that. it's odd, isn't it? But unfortunately, it was such a long interview and good, but we haven't really got time to talk about it in detail as we'd normally. But the book is called Whose Game Is It Anyway? It's published by Pitch. It's by Michael Calvin, and I can't recommend it enough. As it also, it's mainly about football, but it's some very interesting diversions into the world of boxing and sailing, oddly enough. But those are chapters that are very well worth reading as well. It's the end of the pod, Kieran. As always, I will say, if you have any questions for us for our next pod about football finance, it's questions@priceoffootball.com, and I shall hand you over to Mr. Kieran Maguire, inventor of the phrase wank puffin, to say goodbye as always.
Well, once again, folks, thanks for all the reviews. If you want to say something nice about us, or even something rude about us on Apple, and give us a 5-star review, that'll be very welcome. And if you want to support the pod, you can get it for as cheap as £1 a month on Patreon, but the podcast itself will always be free. Other than that, look after yourselves. The Price of Football. Price of Football.